The Coming Revolt of the Guards. The title of this chapter is not a prediction, but a hope, which I will soon explain. As for the subtitle of this book, it is not quite accurate. A people's history promises more than any one person can fulfill, and it is the most difficult kind of history to recapture. I call it that anyway because, with all its limitations, it is a history disrespectful of governments and respectful of people's movements of resistance. That makes it a biased account, one that leans in a certain direction. I am not troubled by that, because the mountain of history books under which we all stand leans so heavily in the other direction. So tremblingly respectful of states and statesmen, and so disrespectful by inattention to people's movements, that we need some counterforce to avoid being crushed into submission. All those histories of this country centered on the founding fathers and the presidents weigh oppressively on the capacity of the ordinary citizen to act. They suggest that in times of crisis, we must look to someone to save us. In the revolutionary crisis, the founding fathers. In the slavery crisis, Lincoln. In the Depression, Roosevelt. In the Vietnam Watergate crisis, Carter. And that between occasional crises, everything is all right, and it is sufficient for us to be restored to that normal state. They teach us that the supreme act of citizenship is to choose among saviors by going into a voting booth every 4 years to choose between two white and well-off Anglo-Saxon males of inoffensive personality and orthodox opinions. The idea of saviors has been built into the entire culture beyond politics. We have learned to look to stars, leaders, experts in every field, thus surrendering our own strength, demeaning our own ability, obliterating our own selves. But from time to time, Americans reject that idea and rebel. These rebellions so far have been contained. The American system is the most ingenious system of control in world history. With a country so rich in natural resources, talent, and labor power, the system can afford to distribute just enough wealth to just enough people to limit discontent to a troublesome minority. It is a country so powerful, so big, so pleasing to so many of its citizens, that it can afford to give freedom of dissent to the small number who are not pleased. There is no system of control with more openings, apertures, leeways, flexibilities, rewards for the chosen, winning tickets and lotteries. There is none that disperses its controls more complexly through the voting system, the work situation, the church, the family, the school, the mass media. None more successful in mollifying opposition with reforms, isolating people from one another, creating patriotic loyalty. 1% of the nation owns a third of the wealth. The rest of the wealth is distributed in such a way as to turn those in the 99% against one another, small property owners against the propertyless, black against white, native-born against foreign-born, intellectuals and professionals against the uneducated and unskilled. These groups have resented one another and warred against one another with such vehemence and violence as to obscure their common position as sharers of leftovers in a very wealthy country. Against the reality of that desperate, bitter battle for resources made scarce by elite control, I am taking the liberty of uniting those 99% as the people. I have been writing a history that attempts to represent their submerged, deflected common interest. To emphasize the commonality of the 99%, to declare deep enmity of interest with the 1%, is to do exactly what the governments of the United States and the wealthy elite allied to them, from the founding fathers to now, have tried their best to prevent. Madison feared a majority faction and hoped the new Constitution would control it. He and his colleagues began the preamble to the Constitution with the words, "We the people," pretending that the new government stood for everyone, and hoping that this myth, accepted as fact, would ensure domestic tranquility. The pretense continued over the generations, helped by all-embracing symbols, physical or verbal. The flag, patriotism, democracy, national interest, national defense, national security. The slogans were dug into the earth of American culture like a circle of covered wagons on the Western Plain, from inside of which the white, slightly privileged American could shoot to kill the enemy outside, Indians or blacks or foreigners or other whites too wretched to be allowed inside the circle. The managers of the caravan watched at a safe distance, and when the battle was over and the field strewn with dead on both sides, they would take over the land and prepare another expedition for another territory. The scheme never worked perfectly. The Revolution and the Constitution, trying to bring stability by containing the class angers of the colonial period, while enslaving blacks, annihilating or displacing Indians, did not quite succeed, judging by the tenant uprisings, the slave revolts, the abolitionist agitation, the feminist upsurge, the Indian guerrilla warfare of the pre-Civil War years. After the Civil War, a new coalition of Southern and Northern elites developed, with Southern whites and blacks of the lower classes occupied in racial conflict. Native workers and immigrant workers clashing in the North, and the farmers dispersed over a big country, while the system of capitalism consolidated itself in industry and government. But there came rebellion among industrial workers and a great opposition movement among farmers. At the turn of the century, the violent pacification of blacks and Indians and the use of elections and war to absorb and divert white rebels were not enough, in the conditions of modern industry, to prevent the great upsurge of socialism, the massive labor struggles before the First World War. Neither that war, nor the partial prosperity of the 20s, nor the apparent destruction of the socialist movement, could prevent, in the situation of economic crisis, another radical awakening, another labor upsurge in the 30s. World War II created a new unity, followed by an apparently successful attempt in the atmosphere of the Cold War to extinguish the strong radical temper of the war years. But then, surprisingly, came the surge of the 60s, from people thought long subdued or put out of sight, blacks, women, Native Americans, prisoners, soldiers, and a new radicalism which threatened to spread widely in a population disillusioned by the Vietnam War and the politics of Watergate. The exile of Nixon, the celebration of the bicentennial, the presidency of Carter, all aimed at restoration. But restoration to the old order was no solution to the uncertainty, the alienation, which was intensified in the Reagan-Bush years. The election of Clinton in 1992, carrying with it a vague promise of change, did not fulfill the expectations of the hopeful. With such continuing malaise, it is very important for the establishment, that uneasy club of business executives, generals, and politicos, to maintain the historic pretension of national unity, in which the government represents all the people, and the common enemy is overseas, not at home, where disasters of economics or war are unfortunate errors or tragic accidents to be corrected by the members of the same club that brought the disasters. It is important for them also to make sure this artificial unity of highly privileged and slightly privileged is the only unity, that the 99% remain split in countless ways and turn against one another to vent their angers. How skillful to tax the middle class to pay for the relief of the poor, building resentment on top of humiliation. How adroit to bus poor black youngsters into poor white neighborhoods in a violent exchange of impoverished schools, while the schools of the rich remain untouched and the wealth of the nation held onto stingily where children need free milk is drained for billion-dollar aircraft carriers. How ingenious to meet the demands of blacks and women for equality by giving them small special benefits and setting them in competition with everyone else for jobs made scarce by an irrational, wasteful system. How wise to turn the fear and anger of the majority toward a class of criminals bred by economic inequity faster than they can be put away, deflecting attention from the huge thefts of national resources carried out within the law by men in executive offices. But with all the controls of power and punishment, enticements and concessions, diversions and decoys, operating throughout the history of the country, the establishment has been unable to keep itself secure from revolt. Every time it looked as if it had succeeded, the very people it thought seduced or subdued stirred and rose. Blacks, cajoled by Supreme Court decisions and congressional statutes, rebelled. Women, wooed and ignored, romanticized and mistreated, rebelled. Indians, thought dead, reappeared, defiant. Young people, despite lures of career and comfort, defected. Working people, thought soothed by reforms, regulated by law, kept within bounds by their own unions, went on strike. Government intellectuals, pledged to secrecy, began giving away secrets. Priests turned from piety to protest. To recall this is to remind people of what the establishment would like them to forget, the enormous capacity of apparently helpless people to resist, of apparently contented people to demand change. To uncover such history is to find a powerful human impulse to assert one's humanity. It is to hold out, even in times of deep pessimism, the possibility of surprise. True, to overestimate class consciousness, to exaggerate rebellion and its successes, would be misleading. It would not account for the fact that the world, not just the United States but everywhere else, is still in the hands of the elites, that people's movements, although they show an infinite capacity for recurrence, have so far been either defeated or absorbed or perverted, that socialist revolutionists have betrayed socialism, that nationalist revolutions have led to new dictatorships.